Hello, everybody. It's Dr. Jamie. Welcome back to the Fit and Fabulous podcast. Thanks for everybody that's listened to all of our previous episodes, for everybody that's left reviews, that's downloaded. You guys have no idea. You help us with our worldwide reach every single time that you like and you share and you send this to your friends and family. You're helping make an impact on someone else's life. Okay. So continue to do that. We appreciate it so much. I want to introduce one of my amazing colleagues and friends, Dr. Robert Sivas, who's joining me today on the Fit and Fabulous podcast. Dr. Sivas is known as the Carb Addiction Doc on social media. And if you're not following him, you are missing out. So go check it out right now. But Dr. Sivas specializes in weight management and bariatric surgery for both adults and children in West Palm Beach, Florida. He's been doing bariatric surgery for many years, many more years than some of our listeners probably. But he began his training in Cape Town, South Africa. And I love listening to him talk because he's still got that wonderful South African accent. But he received his medical degree from the University of Cape Town. Then he moved to North America and completed a residency in pediatric surgery at Ohio State University. Then he went to Canada, where he completed his general surgery residency and specialized in minimally invasive surgery at the University of Toronto. He also earned a PhD in liver carbohydrate metabolism and the effect of glucose metabolism on liver transplant immunology. After completing his pediatric surgery fellowship, he went on to C.S. Mott Children's Hospital and was appointed as an assistant professor of pediatric and fetal surgery at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. He did hepatic stem cell research during his time there. He became very interested in this connection between adolescent obesity and the impact of liver and metabolic syndrome on these young patients. He has an extremely good understanding of the toxicity of chronic excessive carb consumption as the primary cause of obesity. And that is something that we unfortunately are seeing increasing in our world, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. So I think the work that he's doing is so important. Dr. Sivas, welcome to the Fit and Fabulous podcast.
Dr. Seaman, it's great to be here. This is something that is long in the works, and I've loved my keto summits in Omaha the last couple of years. So thanks so much for everything you do.
We were so fortunate to have you. We really were. And because you're a practicing physician, you see patients every day. You put what you say in social media into practice with these real life people, which it's not a bash against any of our colleagues that don't see patients, but I think that's just so important that you're in the trenches right now.
It's absolutely right. It adds perspective to our knowledge base. And so often we have an anecdote of one person's experience or a couple of people's experience, or we have physicians or scientists who work in the space and have a lot of theoretical advantage, but they're not able to apply it clinically to understand certain things. So that's given me an added perspective, as you know, in your own practice. And that added perspective is really about helping our patients. Ultimately, we can have all the theory and the knowledge. That's nice in books and nice in stories. But what we're about is helping people to change their own lives through their behavioral change. And that really is a clinical focus for you and I.
Right. How did you get interested in, I'm a surgeon. I love surgery. I love procedures. There's something really fulfilling, about that. But how did you get into your area of research and expertise in obesity and carb consumption?
Well, I think it's frustration and observation. So the first thing that I found as a pediatric surgeon is I was seeing tons of children for adult-type diseases, polycystic ovarian syndrome with maybe a torsion, or gallbladder disease, acid reflux, diseases that we shouldn't see in children. And all these kids were enormous. They were all heavy, and we really didn't have a modality for helping them with the primary cause of a lot of these problems, which was their obesity. The second, and actually that's not entirely true, because obesity itself is not a problem, it's the result of a problem. And we can talk about that a little bit more, which is also a huge misunderstanding that I've been able to correct. The second part in the laboratory, the frustration came from seeing that the problem was not fat. The problem was not caused by fat. And yet that was the pervasive theory in the 70s, 80s, and 90s when I was at medical school and training, is eat less fat, eat less salt, and exercise more. Kind of the Coca-Cola message. Move more, eat less. And I realized, observing my patients and myself, that that just wasn't true. You know, when you walk into a kid's room after a gallbladder surgery and they weigh 400 pounds and you think, okay, it must be fat because that's the pervading theory of why we get gallstones, saturated cholesterol. And you realize that this kid is eating Skittles and M&Ms and ice cream and French fries and drinking a Dr. Pepper. Where's the fat? Where is the fat? How is it possible that something he's really not consuming has made him so sick? And we ignore this tsunami of sugar and starch. There was just, I mean, everywhere to be seen. So slowly covering my science and the science that I did in the laboratory with the liver and also my observations in the clinical space, coupled with my frustration of seeing obese kids and then doing bariatric surgery eventually and seeing kids lose the weight and then gain it all back. That frustrated the heck out of me because the surgery was very successful, but the result was a failure, or 85% is a failure. So really the question then became, and this is fundamental to our practice, it really isn't about what we eat. It isn't about what we eat. It's about why. Mm-hmm. And until you can help these kids to understand and change the behavior that's associated with why they eat, you're really not going to have success. And that for me has been really the work that we've done so far. And we use bariatric surgery from time to time. We use these other tools. But helping kids and families to understand the why is so, so important. Even with pregnant moms and in obstetrics, that becomes even more important because not only are you doing it to yourself, but you're also doing it to the parasite in your belly. And so you understand that from the work that you do, how important that good start for a fetus is. So it starts before conception.
Yeah. So one of the things I want to talk about is why diets fail. So I don't take care of kids, which it's so unfortunate to see the level of obesity that we see because kids aren't going to the grocery store. They're not doing the shopping. They're not cooking the food. They're just eating what they have availability, you know, too. But I want to pick your brain for just a second too, that when I look at my children and, you know, their friends or just children, you know, across my community, it seems that there's some that are obese and some that aren't, but they're all eating the junk food, right? So what gives from such an early time? Do you think that there's probably the microbiome and all these other environmental, you know, influences that really, you know, throw the fuel on obesity? Or what are your thoughts on that?
I think there are a number of things that add to it, but primarily the shift in our thinking and our observation has been that the problem isn't what you're eating. The problem is not alcohol. You and I, certainly I'll have a glass of red wine every now and then, but I'm not an alcoholic. So I have control over that relationship, and drinking alcohol is one in a diversity of different things that I do for emotional management now. If you are raised in a way that precludes you from having other strategies to deal with emotional tension, it's quite obvious to understand as we grow older, and as teenagers, we get exposed to alcohol, or now the big thing in schools is vaping. We bond with that relationship in excess, in a chronically excessive way, if we don't have effective emotion management skills. Now, if you look at alcohol and nicotine, those things happen in teenagers. But from birth, or in fact, from before birth, and
yeah, this in is utero.
if you do obstetrics, you know in utero, you're imprinting that child's emotion management system,
yes,
based on what the mom does. So if the mom goes for a run or goes to the gym to relieve stress, the hormones associated with that are imprinting on that child. If the mom is eating ice cream to relieve stress, that imprints. And while that's not activated yet, as soon as that child gets exposed to that after it's born, it subconsciously, not intentionally, develops that relationship. And as parents, we are, and because of this, the nutrition guidelines, which for the first time this year, 2020, actually, spoke to kids between the ages of 0 and 2 years old, where they said that we should be eating a lot of fruits, juices, grain products, sugary stuff to our kids. So these kids are started out on breast milk, which is a pure carnivore substance. Mm-hmm. Think about that. Breast milk is pure carnivore. And then suddenly they switched to Cheerios and Goldfish and mac and cheese and skim milk. And we remove all the fat and a large part of the protein, and we expect these children's brains and things to develop. Well, number one, physiologically, we haven't given them the right substrate. But secondly, from a mental health perspective, they lose the need to develop other strategies because the sugar and the starch is so darn effective. You're basically allowing those kids to smoke cigarettes from under a year of age, from when you start feeding them so-called food. Because carbohydrates are no longer necessary as a fuel source for humans in the modern era. They have transitioned away from being sugar to be, at least away from being in the food space to being in the drug space. And I'll just, you know, say, oh, that's not true, that's not true. Jamie, one of the things that I love to look at when people ask me this is very simplistically, how much fat, how much protein, how much cholesterol, how much sodium is there in an egg? And the reality is, in an egg, there's exactly the right amount to make a chicken. So everything in an egg, it supplies all the molecules you need to create life. And we human beings, as you know, whether that embryo is a human egg or a chicken's egg, it produces life. But there is less than 1 gram of sugar in an egg. So if sugar is necessary for human survival, surely it would be present in an egg for a chicken. So carbohydrates are not necessary for human life. Protein and fat are. And as parents, what we've done is we've bought into this subconsciously, bought into this treatment of our kids, treats for our kids. And we feel it is necessary to make them feel good by giving them a highly endorphin activating instant gratification drug called sugar. The number of times that I've been criticized for mistreatment of my own child because he doesn't eat sugar is ridiculous. But in reality, what you're doing is giving them a little bit of obesity, a little bit of diabetes, a little bit of hypertension, a little bit of anxiety, and a little bit of depression. Here it is, all in one bag called Cheerios. Mm-hmm. So that's the position. So I think when you say which kids are out there, it's the kids that have already at a very young age a fundamental foundation of instant gratification using carbohydrates as a drug for emotion management. The other kids that also eat carbohydrates are eating them occasionally for emotional value, but they've also got a variety of other things that are equally present. And it's that diversity that prevents the addiction. The only other comment there is that if you love the effort you put into something, you're going to develop an effort-based emotion management system. If you don't put effort into things that make you feel good, or if you put effort in, but all you ever see is the outcome that wasn't good enough, you don't develop an effort-based foundation of physical activity, of creative arts, of spirituality, meditation, and of human connection as a way to manage emotional need. And then you tend to turn to substances that are already available, sugar and starch from the get-go. So we can talk more about that, but it's about parenting. And it's not a criticism of parents. It's a criticism of how our society has relied on instant gratification more than an effort and time-based way of raising a child with a healthy emotion management system.
Yeah, I definitely agree with the availability. Looking at the school lunch at my kids' school, for instance, very, very carb-heavy, availability of sugar and carbs in these processed foods is everywhere. It's in the grocery store checkout line, right? That's where all the candy is. But there's some controversy. People really don't think that sugar is inherently addictive. So what makes carbs so addictive? Because I certainly have had a patient, you know, with binge eating behavior that says, I made a box of cake mix and I ate the entire bowl of cake batter. But no patient's ever said, I started in on a dozen eggs and I couldn't stop until all dozen were gone.
Right, you're absolutely right.
What makes them addictive?
And that's the point, is that sugar and starch in and itself has exactly the same impact as alcohol. Nobody gets a buzz from water, but we get a buzz from alcohol. And the same thing is true for foods that are not necessary versus foods that are necessary for human survival. Water is necessary for human survival. Whiskey isn't. Sugar and starch, as I said earlier, is not necessary for human survival. And sugar and starch really only offers a caloric advantage. Protein and fat has a huge structural component as well as a nutritional advantage. So when it comes to foods that are nutritionally necessary, there is satiety and satisfaction associated with it. There's a capping point. When you're drinking water, there is subconsciously an end point where my thirst is quenched and there's a stopping point, which is a dilution of sodium in your intestine that sends feedback to your brain that says, I'm done. When you're drinking alcohol, there is no such feedback system. So therefore, the more you drink, the more endorphin activated you are, the more you desire. So you have to consciously control how much alcohol you drink. You never have to consciously control how much water you drink. You can overdrink alcohol to the point of harm. You can't drink water excessively to the point of harm. Exactly the same with protein and fat, which are your other two macronutrients. You can eat a steak or eggs until you're stuffed, until you feel full. But there is always an endpoint, and it's mediated by several hormones in the gut and the fat cells that send a signal back to our brain that says, I'm full. Whereas sugar does not have that. In fact, sugar is an accelerant. It is an endorphin accelerant. And the more we eat, the better we feel. Even binge eating is, you know what cutting is, where people intentionally cut themselves for that. They hurt themselves intentionally for that bizarre opioid response on the back end, which we get from pain. And when you've got intense anxiety, a lot of young kids will cut themselves or hurt themselves intentionally for that anxiolytic relief on the back end. Well, binge eating is exactly the same thing, where we overeat to the point of being uncomfortably full so that we have that bizarre sense of satiety. I'm full of dinner, but I'm sitting in front of the TV with a bag of chips or a bowl of ice cream, stuffing myself. So food has biologic endpoints that are subconsciously mediated through a hormonal mechanism. Sugar and alcohol do not have that mechanism. And that's why they can be addictive. They're not necessary for human survival, and therefore there is no endpoint.
Yeah, interesting. So in the carnivore world, we've seen this shift of people vilifying carbs, now saying maybe whole food carbs are good. It's really just the polyunsaturated fatty acids that are bad and that are causing all the chronic disease. I know you had mentioned earlier, carbs are non-essential for human life. And I have said that in some of my lectures before, right in the Institute of Medicine guidelines, even in pregnancy, they say, as long as you have adequate protein and fat intake, carbs are non-essential for human life. Because we have this, just for our listeners, obviously, you know this, Doc, but you know, we have this process called gluconeogenesis, and we can take substrates of protein and fat and actually make every single carbohydrate or glucose molecule that's required to sustain life. Now, is zero carbs the best thing for everyone? You know, probably not. And so I think some of the controversy is, where do people find that threshold? Like, who should be eating blueberries and squash and things like that?
So, you know, Jamie, this is not difficult to understand. And I use the context of alcoholism to explain it. You're absolutely right. The first change in thinking, don't demonize the substance for the relationship. Alcoholism is about your relationship with alcohol. It isn't about alcohol. Obesity, diabetes, type 2 diabetes, metabolic syndrome is not about carbohydrates. It's about our relationship with carbohydrates. And there are people who can drink alcohol. There are people that can eat carbohydrates very safely because they can handle that relationship. So really what it comes down to is three words that most people are very comfortable with: use, abuse, and addiction. And use is where you use it occasionally for pleasure, or in the old days, 100,000 years ago, for its for its energy survival advantage just before winter. So carbohydrates in dominant availability in our environment used to be just before winter, and it had a survival advantage to that. Now that survival advantage is gone because it's no longer seasonally available, it's ubiquitously available. So there is a pressure to do that, just like with, for example, you speak a lot about this, sex has a very powerful endorphin aspect because it's part of procreation, it's part of survival of the species. However, when you manipulate that feeling, that's where the problem comes in. So the use is occasionally either for energy or for pleasure. For example, athletes, a buddy of ours, I think you know him, Zach Bitter, who's an ultra distance athlete. Zach runs 25 miles in a training run, which is ludicrous. I mean, he runs
most
1 mile.
People couldn't do that if they tried.
Exactly right. I mean, Zach runs 100 miles in a faster pace than I can at a sprint run 1 mile. But so the point is, he, and Zach is this big. So guys like Zach or the athletes, and you work with a lot of athletes, you play with a lot of athletes. Those folks need the rapid energy of some sugar consumption to accommodate for their energy utilization beyond what their liver can make as sugar or beyond what they can use as ketones. And that's a combination of endurance and chronic strength. If I go for a short jog or a run, I don't need sugar. But if you're going to do this for longer than 40 or 45 minutes, you need that added intake of sugar. And most athletes don't have a dependency on sugar. So that's use. The abuse is when you go out on one given day and you pig out on a big pizza and you feel terrible the next day, but you don't eat pizza again for another week. And there are people that do that. A lot of athletes will do that from time to time. Healthy people will do that from time to time. It's the equivalent of me going out, getting hammered one night, having remorse the next day, and not drinking for another month. And then you've got addiction. And addiction is quantified, not by the extent to which you use the relationship, but by to the harm and how effectively you distort the reality of the harm in order to continue the relationship. So, you know, you get drunk one night, not a big deal. Even, and I hate to say this, but even one DUI might be a mistake. But when you've had five DUIs and you have liver disease, that's a problem. When you've got diabetes, when you're more than 50 pounds overweight, you've lost control of the relationship. Mm-hmm. So it really isn't about carbohydrates. It's about a person's use of those carbohydrates on a routine, regular basis to the point of harm. So if you have those negative criteria, if you've caused that kind of harm, it's probably a good idea to abstain. And then when life throws a curveball at you, boom, you're going straight back to it. That's why we use addiction methodology. If you're a use abuse person, yeah, eat the healthier carbohydrates, eat the carbohydrates that have benefit, maybe a potato, maybe some squash, rather than the carbohydrates that are packaged and manufactured, and especially the carbohydrates that are intentionally combined with polyunsaturated fats for that super high. And that's part of the manufacturing scheme, is to combine carbohydrates with ultra processed or industrial oils to give us that extra high. You know, there's polyunsaturated fatty acids in every fat that we eat, pretty much. All animals, that's a component of it. So this whole shift toward blaming polyunsaturated fatty acids is not the issue. It's the manufactured fats that I think are the problem, the heated, when we heat them out of seeds. The fats that I eat are pressed from a fruit or are occur naturally as part of animal fat. And those are the healthier fats, even though they cover the full spectrum.
Right. I think if you went across social media channels, it's like everybody says it differently, but what we're really all saying is processed foods are the devil. I mean, anytime you pulverize something down into a flour, anytime you make a combination of that, something that's got sweet and salty and vegetable oils, these are hyper palatable foods, completely devoid of any nutrients. And when I am talking to patients in clinic and I'll give them a food list, like, listen, these are foods, you should pick things off these lists. And people will see some fruits or even some tuberous vegetables. And they're like, wait, my friend Sally told me I'm not allowed to have any fruit on a ketogenic diet. And I'm like, listen, nobody got diabetes from eating too many blueberries and carrots. Okay. That's not your problem.
So, you're absolutely right, Jamie, but with one caveat, once you're already up there, then it doesn't matter where the sugar happens. It's still a trigger. So, you know, having been 300 pounds, you put a punnet of blueberries in my fridge, I'm doing drive-bys because they're there. Yeah. And I think the intensity to which, for example, the alcoholic drinking the mouthwash, we've got to understand our own behavior under those circumstances. And I focus very heavily on the relationship and the behavior, not just the substance. So where I've never met an obese person or a type 2 diabetic who rushed to the fridge and pigged out on Brussels sprouts. Those, even though they're all vegetables by definition are carbohydrate, they're pretty much all free to eat because they don't trigger that endorphin response. So you're right. When you're treating people who are abusive maybe of their carbohydrate relationship, it's reasonable to give them some access. I know in my own life that if that stuff's in my fridge, I'm in all kinds of trouble. So it really has to be individualized by what your triggers are. Not on a good day, but on a bad day.
Right. Find your weak spots. Know where your blind spots are. That's what I talk about a lot with people. So since you've done so much research in carb metabolism, things like that, let's dive down just a little bit into the weeds of carbs, the difference between fructose, glucose, sucrose. We've mentioned a few different mono and disaccharides. Is there a difference when it comes to development of chronic disease like diabetes and heart disease?
I think one of the critical things that a lot of people don't understand when it comes to carbohydrates, it doesn't matter what form they take going into your mouth. What matters is what enters your bloodstream. And the human intestine is very well equipped to break most non-cellulose, non-vegetable material carbohydrates down into their three component primary molecules, glucose, fructose, and galactose. Galactose primarily coming from milk. Glucose is the dominant one, but fructose and glucose often combining in things like sucrose, in fruit, in most foods. So those three elements, our food is broken down into that. Whether you eat white bread or brown bread, what you're really eating is a chain of sugar, glucose and fructose. And that is what enters the bloodstream. But the bloodstream that it enters is the portal venous system, which is the blood system between the gut and the liver. The liver then is the primary absorber of those sugars and modifies them all. Some of them get re-released into the body and primarily as glucose. So even fructose is absorbed at a very high rate, actually insulin independent, by the liver and transformed as glucose and then shoved back out. The other thing that happens is the liver is very good at turning that excess sugar into fat. So we call a fatty liver, which is one of the commonest, it is the commonest liver disease, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, because of this excess processing of sugar to fat. And we can't ship it out quick enough, so it builds up in the liver. So when it comes to eating, what we've got to understand is not what enters our mouth. And so many people qualify it and have been indoctrinated, an apple is healthy, a donut is not healthy. Well, if you're an obese person, the apple has about twice as much sugar as the donut, and it's exactly the same sugar. It's glucose and fructose. So we've got to understand what's going in. If you're a healthy athlete, the apple is probably better than the donut. Glass of red wine is good for me, but whiskey probably not so much. But if you're an alcoholic, both are on the no list. So then it comes down to what your body is able to do with it. And here's the key thing, that obesity and type 2 diabetes or insulin resistance is really the same thing, dependent on your genetic ability to produce insulin. There are some people, and it's a bell curve like most of biology, some people can produce a huge amount of insulin, and that's obesogenic. Some people can't produce a lot of insulin, and they become diabetic early. They gain some weight, but they become diabetic. Why? What happens is the imbalance between sugar in your bloodstream and sugar inside of the cells. Insulin responds to sugar in your bloodstream. The production and release of sugar responds to intracellular sugar. And there can be this difference. So at first, when you eat a lot of sugar, the sugar floods the cells and the cells get damaged. They get overwhelmed, they get damaged. So the way they do that is to shut the front door. They block the receptor that allows sugar to get in. It's called the insulin receptor. So they block that receptor. So now the sugar is building up in the bloodstream. What does the pancreas do? It says, hey, I need more insulin. It releases more insulin. But eventually you get a cap where the pancreas cannot produce more insulin. So for example, my East Indian patients typically genetically have a very low threshold for producing insulin. So they'll become overweight and then rapidly become diabetic. Some of my South Sea Island patients, some of my Native American patients have a very high threshold for producing insulin. So they become enormous, but they don't have diabetes. Once you stop being the ability to get sugar into the cells, particularly the liver and the fat cells, you gain weight because the liver and the fat cells turn it into fat. Once you stop being able to do that, then it builds up into the bloodstream. And the key thing to understand, Jamie, and you know this, is that sugar in excess is toxic in every single space in the body. It's toxic in the intestine, irritable bowel syndrome, other inflammatory syndromes, the gut. You talked about the biome. It is inflammatory in the blood vascular space. It affects the red blood cells and the white blood cells, causing our immune system to overreact. And you know, that's why people die of COVID, not because COVID kills us, but because of our inflammatory disease, COVID kind of slips in the back door and takes advantage of a super inflamed person. But it also damages the endothelial cells in the blood vessels, which causes blood clots. Changes, for example, in the uterus, the uterine blood supply or blood system, increasing fibroids and AUB. We can talk about some of that, but also affects the heart. You get blood clots forming, you get strokes, you get heart attacks, and blocks some of those narrow vessels. erectile dysfunction, toes drop off, kidney function, Alzheimer's, eyes, that's diabetes. It can get into the cells where it gets turned to fat, but that excess sugar in the cells causes intracellular inflammation. We can measure that with ferritin, for example, but also leads to changes in the genetics in the nucleus. Both insulin and sugar do that. So it activates things like the HER2/neu and the BRAC genes. Breast cancer has done this in my lifestyle, in my lifetime, so that it's the number one cancer, as far as I'm aware, in women. That's not normal. That's not the way it should be, but that's activated by insulin resistance and sugar. But it also increases the risk of cancers, of intracellular inflammation, and also Alzheimer's. So sugar is toxic in every cellular or in every system in the body. And the question is, which area in the body is it allowed to build up in the most? And that's defined by insulin and insulin resistance. So it's much more complex than just eating carbohydrates and obesity causing all these diseases. The final thing I'll say is the ability to rapidly gain weight protects you from the damage of sugar. So that only when you stop being able to produce a lot of fat does it really start to cause biologic harm. The one biologic harm that high insulin resistance does cause, it affects steroid hormone production, which is mediated by insulin. And you see that a lot in your profession with PCOS, as opposed to gestational diabetes, which is a different disorder. The two typically don't commingle. But we see that a lot with men with low testosterone, women with progesterone, estrogen issues, and higher testosterone. And then we also see body distribution. So we see the lipedema in females, where they store that fat in their lower body. And that is an insulin resistance mediated thing, as opposed to the more testosterone dominant women that have the coarser hair and the bigger body. So body morphology is also determined by insulin resistance and its impact on steroid hormone production. A lot of words, a lot of statements, but yeah. It really comes down to what insulin does in your body, how it gets into your bloodstream and what it does when it gets there.
Yeah, I love it. The body is so fascinating. So let's pivot just a little bit. One thing that's just been attacked in the last 20 years is fat. We've kind of keyed on that, but now particularly red meat. Red meat causes cancer. Red meat causes heart disease. Can you talk about kind of this cholesterol hypothesis of heart disease and where we've kind of gone wrong there? Because I'm a gynecologist, but I'm one of the only well-versed kind of ketogenic practitioners in my community. So it's not uncommon for patients to come to me and say, I've been, you know, low carb, ketogenic or carnivore for X amount of years. And this is my cholesterol panel. And my doctor is terrified and they'd like me to start this statin immediately.
Right. So let's step back to the history. There really are two competing bits of evidence. And this really started in the 1950s and 60s, when more and more people were dying of heart attacks and strokes. And when they did autopsies on people that died of heart attacks and strokes, almost always they found their blood vessels clogged with this thick gelatinous muck. And when they analyzed it, it was cholesterol and saturated fat. So the knee-jerk response when you make an observation is to say, okay, how is this fat getting there? And the observation was these people are eating a lot of fat and therefore they are clogging up their blood vessels with all the fat they're eating. Now, there are two issues with that theory. The first issue is in the 1950s and 60s, we'd absolved the primary cause of that fat being there from any wrongdoing. So if your mindset is that smoking and nicotine causes no harm, which was the mindset until the late 70s, which was a strong belief even held by physicians, but fostered very heavily by the tobacco company, then you've absolved nicotine and you're not even looking at it. Secondly, we didn't do the same autopsies on people that didn't die of heart attacks and strokes. So if you look at people who had pristine blood vessels that died, and you look at people that had fat clogged blood vessels, the difference was not in the fat they were eating. The difference was whether they were smoking or not, because everybody pretty much ate the same diet. But that cognitive distance we didn't really look at that because we weren't blaming cigarettes. And then some powerful voices at the time, Ansel Keys and a few others, condemned fat immediately. So, we bought into that. And so we demonized fat and we took fat out of our diet. Well, the problem is that fat tastes like crap. Food tastes like crap when you take the fat out. Mm-hmm. So what did we start doing? And we also, remember the 1977 McGovern Commission was convened to look at starvation and undernutrition in rural America. It wasn't seeing obesity. It was looked at how do we feed more people cheaply? How do we make food more available? Well, the easiest way to make food more available is to manufacture it. And what did we do? Because we believed sugar was very healthy. It's so important for our brain, blah, 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 which is not true. But we started to manufacture high carbohydrate foods. And the era of instant food production, really manufactured food came along, and it was primarily sugar-based. And then what kind of fat do you add to it? Well, saturated fat is so bad for us. So therefore, we want to add polyunsaturated fat that must be better. So butter was replaced with margarine. The pressed oils were replaced with seed oils or Crisco manufactured oils. And that era of obesity started. But the problem that we also didn't understand, because again, just like with tobacco, we'd made sure that sugar was necessary for survival. Think about TPN that's got 25% of sugar in it, because it's so important for the brain. For the last decade, I've run all my patients with zero sugar in their TPN, and they've gotten a lot easier because in the hospital, we're making these patients diabetic with their TPN and expecting them to get better. But that's the dissonance that we physicians have fallen into. So when you buy into the fact that sugar is necessary and you absolve it of any wrongdoing, then you continue to blame fat. The problem is when I walked into those kids' rooms that were obese and had gallstone disease or polycystic ovarian syndrome with torsion, they weren't eating a lot of fat. So we've reduced our fat consumption tremendously. Our beef consumption has gone down. We're eating more chickens. We're eating more lean beef, lean animals, and we're eating more vegetables and grain products and plants. But here's the problem, Jamie. Our obesity rates are going through the roof. Our cardiovascular history is going through the roof. Our cancers are going through the roof. Our diabetes rates, our insulin. You know, I read a study the other day that said that 61% of American children are insulin resistant at 5 years of age. Years of age, they have insulin resistance. And they're not going to recover from that. So we have not understood that the problem here is not the fat in our diet. It's the sugar. Now, biologically, if you look at this, sugar and nicotine damage the endothelial cells. They damage the cells that line our blood vessels. That then initiates a clotting cascade because a little clot plugs the hole that was created by sugar. That's how the body repairs itself. And sometimes that clot dissolves and the tissue heals, but in the presence of ongoing nicotine or sugar, that hole remains. The fibrous clot becomes infiltrated with cells, platelets, and then lymphocytes. My PhD was looking at platelet activation in those clots. And how I caused the damage? I infused sugar. I infused sugar into animals and I could create the disease that we now call diabetes. And then right at the end, the last piece of clotting, like spackle when there's a hole in your wall, is the fat and the cholesterol that gets laid down. So the change in thinking is that sugar is the arsonist and saturated fat and cholesterol is not the arsonist, but the fireman trying to put out the fire. Well, if you don't have any fire, if you have healthy blood vessels, the fat is just going around your body to feed your tissues, but it isn't really causing those clots.
It's so, like Alzheimer's, you know, which is called type 3 diabetes. When researchers were looking at initial interventions for Alzheimer's, you form plaques, right? Plaques around these neurons, and their initial drug targets were to dissolve the plaques. And when they did that, people got worse and they died faster and they didn't realize it was a protective mechanism. You know, and people don't quite understand that. That's your body trying to protect you from whatever insult you're just throwing in there.
Right, and the brain needs cholesterol, it needs saturated fat. And the older we get, while we're not turning over our brain cells, we're continuously repairing them. And all the membranes on the outside of the cell plus inside of the cell contain cholesterol. Even though the brain is a tiny percentage of our human body, 20% of the human body's cholesterol is in the brain. 65% of the human brain is saturated fat. So we need that as an ongoing substrate. But if you're eating a low-fat diet and now you're on a statin for cholesterol, how do you repair your brain tissue? And as young people, and Alzheimer's doesn't start at 65. It's noticeable then, but it probably starts in our teens or 20s, because what's happened is our brains have a massive excess of brain tissue relative to the amount we use them. And so we can tolerate a lot of brain death or cellular dysfunction before it becomes noticeable. But in our 60s and our 70s, enough death has happened, enough damage has happened that we start to notice it. So the brain has two options. It either repairs those cells, and you need available substrate to be able to repair those brain cells. Or if you don't have the building blocks to repair it, those brain cells suffer, they don't work well, and they die. And the way the brain replaces it is with colloid mucus called, it's a protein, a mucoid protein that sits in the brain and replaces the deficits left by these cells. And if you've got the APOE4 gene, of which I've got one, through my mother, I've got one allele of that. That gene slows down the rate at which your brain cells repair themselves. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have adequate substrate, I can't change the rate at which my brain repairs itself. But I also don't want it waiting for substrate to arrive. You know, for example, we're doing a construction in our home. We're adding a room to our home. And we've been waiting around for 4 months because the supply chain isn't providing parts to our house. So the house is a mess. Well, in exactly the same way, the same thing happens in the brain. There's not enough substrate. Everything hangs around, but the cells die. And the protein is called amyloid protein. And it gets laid down in the brain and other organs as well, like the pancreas, for example. And you get this amyloid tissue building up over time. And we call that that disease dementia or Alzheimer's. Yeah. And there are multiple causes, but the primary cause in human beings right now is a lack of adequate substrate and too much sugar.
Yeah. And I had a wonderful podcast for anybody that's interested, Dr. Mary Newport, who's a neonatologist down in Florida, actually, whose husband had Alzheimer's, and she's written a book on this topic. So go check out that podcast if you're interested. Okay, so I want to talk about how to feed a baby. You and your wife had a new little blessing into the world in the last year or two. And just yesterday, I received three messages from Instagram followers that are frustrated with our current availability of infant formulas. You know, they're like, I'm having trouble breastfeeding. I know breast milk is what's best for my baby. I'm having trouble keeping up with supply, but all of these American formulas are filled with glucose, syrup, solids, and vegetable oils.
baby milkshakes is what we're giving
how
them.
How do we feed our young? Of course, we understand breast milk is number one, but what can
and you know, Jamie, my wife, Janae, had terrible postpartum depression. She's the least likely person to have the kinds of behavioral issues that lead to addiction. But she had she was an elective C-section, had horrible postpartum depression. And as part of that care, we stopped breastfeeding. She wasn't able to produce adequate breast milk. So we only had breast milk available for our son for about a month, maybe 6 weeks. So I understand exactly the trauma that these patients are going through. And having lived through this ourselves with a mom that's really struggling mentally, as well as not having that breast milk, and then looking at the crap that's available out there, that's an issue. So let me just step back for a second. There are two parts to the reasons why we need to feed the baby adequately. The first thing is because the thing that you cannot change, and that we've got about 4 years, including the in utero time, to develop is the brain. The body is very adaptable. The body you can feed over time, but you've got about 4 years to give the baby to best satisfy the baby's genetic advantage based on brain growth. And the brain is primarily cholesterol and saturated fat and a little bit of protein. So in breast milk, if you look at the amount of fat that's available, and especially the essential fats, the DHA and the 3 omega fatty acid substrates, as well as the 6 omegas, those in the right proportion are critical in the human brain. And breast milk usually gives us the best, but what's interesting, Jamie, is if the mother eats a standard American diet, I read a paper the other day that shows there's in the standard American diet versus a mom who's more on the carnivore and or a ketogenic diet, there was 130% difference in the available DHA and EPA and 3 omega fatty acid substrates between those two populations. Mm-hmm. So it's not just breast milk. Mom, I called the baby a parasite the other day. The baby's feeding, whether it's in utero or on the breast, is feeding what mom eats. And it's so important that a breastfeeding mom, and certainly a pregnant mom before the pregnancy even, eats correctly. And, you know, for example, even just neural tube defects that we see, that's folate deficiency. Yeah. You know that well enough. And you start that before you get pregnant because the brain starts to develop at 6 weeks of gestation, before a lot of moms even know they're pregnant. You know, that's an important concept. If you're planning your pregnancy, start eating better before the pregnancy. However, after the baby's born, if you can't breastfeed, we want something that looks like breastfeed. But here's what we humans have said. We've basically said in this country, we're better than God and nature. We know more than God and nature does. So we're going to take breast milk and improve on it. We know exactly what's in breast milk. There's certain things we can't put in there. Some of the immunoglobulins and some of those things. They're important, but they're probably less important. But we said, no. God and nature are wrong to give our babies so much saturated fat and salt and everything else. We've got to make formula with no salt in it, high in the polyunsaturated fatty acids, and high in vegetables, because that's what's healthier. So these people have decided to improve on God and nature, and that's a big human mistake. Mm-hmm. So what they've done is they've added a bunch of vegetable-based products, a lot of the products are soy-based, and they've enriched the sugar content. So the sugar content is about a third higher, but more importantly, they've radically reduced the fat content. Now,
set up the addiction early.
But here's what they've done. They've then said, oh my God, we're starting to see all these brain abnormalities. I mean, and this is very controversial, but I'm very comfortable in the space. Autism rates and autism spectrum disorders have gone from 1 in 15,000 in 1970 to 1 in 49 last year, or in 2019. That is not a genetic abnormality, as the world would have us believe, that we're not able to use substrate. It is the absence of fat in that newborn baby's formula that is the driving force. And even the drug manufacturers, without saying that, realized it. So now what they do is they take this turd that is formula. I mean, think about eating your dog's poop, which is really what the foundation of formula in this country is. Now they sprinkle a little bit of DHA into that and call it brain healthy. If you look at Enfamil, it says on a big label, brain healthy, added DHA, but they've taken out all the other fat substrate. So the way I look at that is basically feeding your baby poop with a few nice things sprinkled on it, but it doesn't change the fact that it's incorrect. So what we ended up doing is we try to get something like raw goat's milk, and we were unable to get that. Why goat's milk? Because raw goat's milk most closely resembles human milk. Human breast milk, correct. It's not, cow's milk is not good in the first year. After 1 year, cow's milk is worthwhile. However, we imported formula from Germany, from Switzerland, that had the adequate substrates. And on my wife, Carb Addiction Mom's YouTube channel and on her Instagram account, you can see the types of formula we used. But from very early on, every other day, I added a little bit of krill oil, which is the only substrate, the only supplement that I take because of my Alzheimer's history. We added a little bit of that to one bottle of milk for my son. And knowing that, you see, here's the beauty. If you overdo DHA, it's a polyunsaturated fat, but the body just converts it to other types of fat. So you can't overdo it in abundance, but you can be deficient. So the other piece, so that was the formula that our baby was fed. But the other thing about carnivore is that a baby, or about food, is that a healthy baby can be weaned starting at a very early age. From about 4 months on, a healthy term baby, their intestine is healthy enough that it can start breaking down and incorporating real food, as long as you do it properly. Well, what all animals do is they chew up the food and then spit that food out for the baby. So as long as you watch the choking hazard, you can puree food, you can blend food. My son's first meal at 4 months of age, on the day he turned 4 months, was a big chunk of ribeye steak, which had...
It wasn't rice, oatmeal, like all these first baby foods that
were
wildly promoted.
Yeah, crystal meth, crack cocaine, and heroin. It's diabetes, obesity, and autism. that you're starting to feed your kid. And I'm not being harsh when I say that, because you have one shot at this. There is no protein and fat of adequate proportions in that. Plus, certainly the grain products. Remember, this baby, I just said that a term baby's intestine is ready for real food at 4 months. Well, one of the common things we see in premature babies is necrotizing enterocolitis, where a premature baby does not have an adequately developed intestine with the right enzymes available to it. The intestinal wall, I operate on these babies, very, very thin wall that can't tolerate even breast milk. That's why breast milk is so much better than formula in these neck babies. However, if you start feeding your baby gluten at 4 months, how do you think that gluten is going to activate all the inflammation in that newborn baby's gut that's just for the first time struggling to be exposed to real food? You really want to feed the baby the blandest food, and the blandest food is animal product. The blandest food is animal product. But we're using rice cereal to thicken formulas for reflux that comes from sugar. Mm-hmm. Most people that have tried a bit of carnivore dieting realize their reflux gets better. Well, exactly. Really? In the baby. Yeah, very quickly. And why is that different from babies? It's exactly the same thing. So, you know, the other thing about feeding babies is we predetermine how much they should feed, and we feed them that amount. Nobody knows, no mother knows how much the baby has had from the breast. So, but by some magical formula, we calculate how much formula a baby needs per feed, and good moms are going to sit there overfeeding their babies. Mm-hmm. And the beauty about allowing the baby to predetermine how much it feeds, some feeds will be a little bit too little, and some feeds the baby will be hungry. So if you offer it enough, but stop when you recognize those
normal satiety.
Exactly. It's so, so important. But good moms especially, oh, I've got to have more, got to have more. Now you've got reflux and my baby's throwing up. So what do? They change the formula to elemental formulas. They thicken the formulas with rice and more carbohydrate, making the problem worse.
Yeah.
I don't think that anything in our human system is as poorly managed as the second half of a neonate's life. In other words, from 6 months to a year of age. And by 6 months, every child should be eating some kind of formula. So, you know, the best thing to feed a baby, and they don't have teeth by 4 months, they can suck on that piece of meat, they can suck on that, get the taste for the fat and the protein, which is what they're getting in their milk anyway. And you know what's interesting, Jamie, about our son, and it's not because he's genetically superior or anything, I really believe that it's because of his diet. By the time he was 11 months old, he had all 20 of his baby teeth.
Wow.
Babies only have 20. Most kids are having, started brushing his teeth at 9.5 to 4 months, to 10 months of age. Yeah. And I don't think it's because he was genetically superior. I think it's because he was primarily eating meat. In fact, he was only eating meat and he was chewing meat. And if you listen to
somebody like, you need some teeth, brother.
Well, if you listen to the paleo dentist, if you want to save yourself 10 or 20 grand in these children, every child in America pretty much ends up in an orthodontist chair having their teeth straightened. Well, if you listen to the paleo dentists, they'll tell you that no hunter-gatherer society had bad teeth. Whether it was the Chinese, whether it was the Maoris, whether it was the Aborigines, the Bushmen, the native Indians in this country, everybody had normal teeth because they ate meat. It's when we started sucking back oatmeal and crap that our teeth became English. If I can use that phrase. Now in this country, we have to straighten our teeth. So you're going to save yourself 10 grand by doing that. But you know, our baby, we have not spent a dime on baby food. Since we weaned him, he's eaten what we've eaten.
Right.
The only money we spent on was that formula. And then at a year, we went to whole milk with extra heavy cream in it, because whole milk in this country has had some of the cream taken out. Mm-hmm. So what he still drinks is whole milk or water, with a little bit of added heavy cream and some fish oil every other day. That's it. Those are his drinks, water and those two. And you know what? He's not miserable because he's been deprived. He's one of the happiest kids out there. The other part that I think is essential, apart from the nutrition, is to raise that baby with praise for effort. And rather than raising the brain, every baby will learn to read and write. They don't have to learn to read and write by 4 months of age. But we put our babies under so much outcome pressure to perform. Praise what they do. Praise their little efforts. They're growing. They have these as instincts. And raising a child with praiseful, effort-based emotion management strategies that include physical activity, include the creative arts, the spiritual part. Spirituality is not just church and Bible. It's more about an ongoing dialogue with a higher power to help you to deal with difficult issues. If you give that child a time component to their lives where they chill out and relax so that their subconscious shows them what the issues of the day are, they will develop an effort-based foundation as their emotion management strategy. And even though they're exposed to drugs like carbohydrates or alcohol and nicotine down the road, they're not going to choose those. You get high on physical activity every day. I see you post about it. That's your drug, but there's no harm from it. Does that make sense? So you use a spiritual basis, you use an effort basis for your emotion management so that you don't need those other things. And that starts in infancy with our kids.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so we're gonna wrap up here because I know that we're super busy. The end of all of my podcasts, Dr. Seibas, I end with something called the semen analysis, because you can't be gifted such a wonderful last name like semen and not use it for marketing. So anyway, so Dave Asprey recently shared, you had kind of touched on the importance of diet and kind of your theory with the increasing rates of autism, but he was sharing a study on polybrominated diphenyl ethers, which are called PBDEs, which is a class of fire retardant chemicals. And they're found in upholstery and our clothing and our carpets. And it's an environmental pollutant that's in our water and soil and everywhere. But they were looking at the amount of these PBDEs in breast milk. So these are still breastfed babies, and the relationship with autism spectrum disorders. And there was definitely a positive clinical correlation with the amount of them found in the breast milk and children that went on to have a diagnosis. But this is not anything new. So I pulled up this study that was done just a couple of years ago, looking at the urine of pregnant women. So we had touched on the importance of diet and this epigenetic influence, and that a lot of these things are set in utero before the baby is even ever born. And this particular study looked at phthalates, phenols, PFCs, flame retardants, PCBs, and there was 90 to 100% of them found in all of these maternal specimens. So I'd like to know where the 10% of women were and what cave they were living in, because 90 to 100% is pretty dang high. And then they also looked at the fetal urine, and then they looked at the cord blood. So they were trying to figure out if it was in the mom, was it always in the baby? Was it maybe some exposure after the baby was born? And there was basically a correlation all the way across. So it's coming from the mom. But when you look at the effects of these things in early development, more allergic disease, more cognitive and behavioral problems with development, infertility, endocrine disruption, reduced, you know, fetal growth. We know there's a risk of preterm birth and small for gestational age babies, and lots of problems with thyroid dysfunction. So diet is so important, but I just wanted to kind of bring this up and highlight that our industrialized world comes at a cost. Like all of the amazing technologies and your car and all the things that we have, you know, as a luxury to us, they all come at a cost. And so for all the pregnant women out there listening, Dr. Seibas is absolutely right. You have these critical years prior to conception, during your pregnancy, and in your baby's early years of life, where that you could make a profound impact on our generations to come in this world. So just something to highlight. Nobody's perfect. We can't live in a cave. We just have to do our best and figure out our emotional management system, because a lot of the bad habits we have in our life come from the fact that we're trying to escape whatever reality we're living in. So Dr. Seibas, thank you for coming, spending some time with us, and helping spread these important messages.
Jamie, thank you so much. And thanks very much for what you do for our community and spreading the word as well, because you can have the best knowledge in the world. If you can't get it out there, it has no value. And I think that in this world of noise, we need to be able to evaluate and help people to think. I don't care if you agree or disagree with me, but if I've made you think, if we today have made people think a little bit differently about how they live lives and what's important to them, we've done our job. Agree or disagree, I'm not going to tell anybody what they have to do, but I will share my opinion as something to weigh against the pervasive opinion of things that aren't leading us down a good pathway. every individual has to decide for themselves how they want to live their own lives.
Thank you guys so much for listening to the Fit and Fabulous podcast. Thanks to Dr. Sivas again. Make sure you share this with somebody. Leave us your comments, share it on your social media channels, download the episodes and leave your review. Thanks again, Dr. Sivas. We'll talk soon.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.